From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. On today's show, the intersection between police and the public. Tensions between law enforcement and protesters are high everywhere in the nation. But we'll explain the Atlanta way of calming those tensions and why some activists don't think it's the right approach.
We are pushing back against the Atlanta way because we recognize that in order for a political agenda to prioritize Black, poor LGBTQ folks, that we have to get rid of all the formalities that only serve as formalities, that only serve as formalities to progress these communities in a real way.
After that, a piece of history is unearthed in an unlikely spot, and also some men were felons, they're now also firefighters. That's all coming up this hour. First, though, Thursday we heard the story of more than a dozen young teenage girls who were locked up in a stockade in Americus, Georgia for nearly 2 months in 1963. Their crime was demonstrating for civil rights. GPB's Bradley George introduced us to some of those women as they returned to the stockade for the first time in decades.
Even though it held me then, it don't hold me now. So when I left, I didn't take this with me.
That story got a big response from you. Here are your first thoughts. On GPB Macon's Facebook page, the granddaughter of the youngest captive, Sandra Mansfield, shared more details. She was 12 years old, and she had her 13th birthday in the Leesburg stockade. Lex Peavy wrote, I thank God for my grandmother telling her grandchildren her story. She made us open our eyes to a brand new light growing up to what the world really used to be like back when she was growing up. The only thing my grandmother always wanted was to shine the light on what happened at the Leesburg stockade. And Lisa Bayer wrote on Twitter, how far we've come, how far we have yet to go. We always love getting your thoughts. And what are some of the places that you want to talk about? Maybe hidden histories. You can find us on Twitter at OST Talk or call us at 404-500-9457. Also, you can post to Facebook as well. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Thousands of people took to the streets in Atlanta last week. They were protesting recent police shootings of two African-American men. Organizers met with Mayor Kasim Reed and other city officials to talk about police reform.
Obviously, they have concerns about policing, and we had a very substantive conversation about the way that we believe the police conduct themselves.
It's hard to hear the mayor there. He's saying that they had a substantive conversation about police procedures. The protests here, for the most part, have been peaceful. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution columnist Bill Torpy credits that to the way Atlanta has handled dissent and protest in the past. But recent violence around the country has raised questions about how law enforcement can serve as both protectors and peacemakers. And Bill joins me now. It's good to have you.
How are you doing?
So it was interesting to me that you, in one of your columns on this, one of your pieces on this, you quote the head of the state police training agency, and he's talking about a warrior mentality among modern police officers. I wonder what that means, that warrior mentality.
Well, that was a fellow named Ken Vance, and he heads the state training department. And it was he was at a meeting where a bunch of preachers and police chiefs were meeting to try to kind of get some sort of dialogue going with communities trying to tamp down the anti-police mentality. And he was saying that there needed to be more of a servants, not warriors. The idea that you would go in and talk to the lady, get out of your car while you're on patrol, talk to the lady on the porch because she knows what's going on in the neighborhood. What happens a lot of times is there's a lot of crime going on and people won't come forward to the police. They won't talk to the police, either because they have had run-ins with them themselves or they just feel that they won't be helped.
So when people talk about the Atlanta way, a lot of times they're referring historically to the civil rights movement and that relationship between Black leaders and Atlanta business leaders and how that led to more peaceful dialogue and a solution to disagreements through meetings, personal meetings, face-to-face relationships.
Right.
How does that translate now to the city's approach to protests?
Well, I think part of it is that, interestingly, for instance, Chief George Turner was an aide to Andrew Young years ago. When he first started out, he was a driver for Andrew Young. He learned firsthand while driving around all over the city with the then Mayor Young, you know, how things are done, how interpersonal relationships occur. And you don't have to be antagonistic, at least all the time.
So one of the things that distinguishes Atlanta's police force is its diversity. How have they been successful, where other cities have not, in hiring a police force that's more representative of its community?
Well, that has been, I guess, a conscious effort with the department. I think I pulled the figures, and it was something like it almost matches what the population is, you know, 52% black, 39% white, what have you. And, I mean, it almost was exactly along those figures.
Yeah, it's just a few percentage points.
A few years ago, there were some stories coming out that police departments were overwhelmingly white in black neighborhoods. And black cities, for instance, and that saw a disconnect between the force and the communities. Although it's not as simple as that, because a lot of departments have tried to get black officers, and they've just had issues with that for whatever reason.
I wanted to take a listen to a clip from one of the protesters. He's part of the Atlanta Is Ready group. This is Avery Jackson, and he's talking about why he wants to get rid of the Atlanta Way.
The Atlanta Way is this civil rights tradition of having one leader who's suited and booted, who might preach on a Sunday, but who gets invited to the table, and his job, and his, because he's a man, his job is to relay the message back to the people, but never to give the people an opportunity to relay the message back up.
Do you feel like that's a fair characterization of how the Atlanta Way works today?
Well, to some extent. I mean, there's always going to be people, young people, pushing back, I guess, if they're not the man who's suited and booted, so to speak. Then they will be looking at it somewhat from the outside. So, there was the three or four different groups that were there at the meeting with the mayor, and there was a little bit of inner battle between the groups as to who was being heard, who was being the voice of the protests. And, you're never going to have a true voice for the protests, because there's always going to be divergent people speaking.
So let's go a little bit further into what this means in terms of police trying to maintain a balance between safety and freedom. And it was interesting to me in some of your writing, you quoted a retired detective, Ken Allen, who said it's not policing that has changed, but it's the police, because cost cutting has meant that they've lost institutional memory. What does that mean?
Right. Well, that's what's happened in a lot of places, including the newspapers and radio, too.
It's true.
In Atlanta, for instance, they have changed the way the pension works. A lot of older people have left, and a lot of younger people aren't going to stay for as long, because they see better opportunities either in other departments or even outside of policing. That is one of the problems that large departments have had, is getting good recruits and then keeping the good recruits. And that's what he said. He said that, we aren't like other jobs. We can take your life and your freedom away. So we should be trained and we should be paid, and you should try to keep good police officers on the forces.
What did people talk about was lost? What is lost when you lose the older generation of police officers?
Well, you lose the glue that keeps a department together. You lose institutional memory, as you said. You lose, because people have to make split decisions. And a new officer, with a year or two, is going to have fear jump in quicker. I mean, fear is always there, but I think the older officers are able to ascertain what's happening in a situation and react in a better, they have experience on their side, so they can react better.
And yet it appears that the Atlanta Police and Chief Turner are thinking things through in sort of a deliberate fashion. I say that because you describe the meeting that they had, in which they were talking about more community-based policing. And not long after that meeting took place, there was the tragedy in Dallas. And people questioned, should those police officers in Dallas have been wearing riot gear? Should they have been better protected? But when Atlanta protests occurred, the police chose not to wear riot gear. Why?
It's an interesting point there that, in fact, the Dallas shootings happened that night after the Mr. Vance said, we need to be servants, not warriors. I called him back the next day. I said, well, what do you think now? Do you change? Does this change your feelings? He said, not one bit. I guess it is a hard decision to do, but the thought is that if you don't go in looking like you're expecting a riot, that you won't be as antagonistic, and that won't raise up the other side's ire as quickly. Chief Turner did tell me that, we did have our shields and helmets in the cars, so I mean, we could react to if anything did happen, we could react. But I think part of it is not going in. I'm from Chicago, so I've been seeing a lot of the 1968 police riots, so to speak, on TV recently. And that was just kind of a lesson in not how to do things.
So what is the estimation of how the Atlanta police is doing? And I ask that in light of the lawsuits filed in 2009 after the raid of the Atlanta Eagle went so very badly. On balance, how do we evaluate Atlanta police and their performance?
Oh, well, I talked to Dan Grossman, who is the attorney who filed the suit, and he's been and that was in 2009. There was a raid on a gay bar, and the police, Red Dog Squad, and other officers were very rough, needlessly, on a lot of the patrons. Anyway, Grossman has been watching. He's the attorney. He's been watching the department since then. He's filed other suits, and he said that that they've handled the protests well. They've handled the training and discipline as well as he wants to see. Chief Turner does have a different feeling about that. But that is something that has been under scrutiny for many years.
We've only got about a minute left, but have they changed their training policies, especially in terms of de-escalation?
They have, to some extent. There are fewer, or actually right now I think it's about the same in excessive force complaints. Whether you're getting more complaints because there's more excessive force or people feel more confident about coming forward where they wouldn't have done it before, that is a question. It's one of those things that's hard to ever determine.
All right. Thanks so much to Bill Torpy. He is a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You can find a link to his column, Bill Torpy at Large, at gpbnews.org. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Renovations have begun on a 19th century cotton mill in Greensboro, Georgia. The mill will become a craft brewery and loft apartments. But 11 years ago, developer Nathan McGarity made a surprising discovery in the mill's rafters. He found a trove of old letters and pictures that revealed a little-known piece of Georgia history. And Nathan joins me this morning. Hi, Nathan.
Good morning.
Also with us is Stephen Brown. He's archivist emeritus at the University of Georgia's Hargrett Rare Book and Manuscript Library, where the collection is now stored. Thanks for being with us as well, Stephen.
Good morning from Athens.
Nathan, can you first describe how you discovered you were taking a walk of the property with a former owner? How did you find these boxes?
Well, we were actually walking around with the former maintenance director of the mill, and this guy's been around since they were using leather belts on machinery. So it's really interesting to ask him a lot of questions. He knew all the history of the mill, and we were walking. The mill had been in bankruptcy, so it was completely almost vacant of a machinery. It was part of a court order back in 2005. And anyhow, looked up, asked what was in those boxes, and with a puzzled look, it was like he had never asked the question himself and was a little embarrassed that he didn't know. And it turned out it was four wooden crates that had been nailed shut, and we were the first ones to open them in 61 years.
And when you opened them, from what I understand, they were in surprisingly good shape.
Yeah, archival methods are not to keep it between 15 and 110 degrees and at, you know, 80% humidity. I'm sure that's not their recommendation, but the documents were, the linen paper was as white as cotton. There were no silverfish. It had been wrapped in butcher paper, and the pine boxes, nail shop, I don't know if it was just the height that it just never had never had any deterioration whatsoever. We actually had photographs that were as brand new.
Clear, yeah. Stephen, can you give me some context on how surprising that is, that after all that time, decades and decades, they would still be in that kind of condition?
Oh, it's astounding. Normally the heat, I would have thought, would have aged terrifically. Obviously, it's been very dry and must have been pretty well moderated as far as temperature, because it is, as Mason said, it looks like it came out of the typewriter yesterday. It's beautiful.
Stephen, what kind of size is this collection? How many documents and photos are in it?
The photographs, I'd say there's probably about 30 photographs in three segments, workers in the mill, exterior of the mill, and then a wonderful collection of the mill village, the housing. So three components, and each one probably contains about 10, 15 photographs of each. The rest of the collection fits in about five boxes, large document boxes.
So Mill Village is probably not something that people are very familiar with, Nathan. I mean, again, when we're talking about the 19th century, that means we're talking about the 1800s. Did workers live right near the mill where they worked?
They did, actually. And this mill probably is not really a good example of just you know, run of the mill. This mill was this was one of the only mills in the state, actually, as of 1910, and 171 textile mills out there. This was the only one named after the founders' wives. So they took a lot of pride. The founders built houses, stately houses, only a block away. The curbing was lined with granite. They did have mill houses, and the mill maintained them up until the 1950s, 1955, I think is when they sold off the mill houses to the people, you know, to the employees that lived there. But it was a wonderful community. It really was.
Now, the letters themselves, they go pretty far into the weeds in details on sort of some changes happening in labor law and how that involved the federal government and the mill. And we don't have to get into all those details because they're weedy. But what's the, in broad strokes, what were all these letters talking about?
Pretty much in broad strokes, it was the Textile Workers Union of America bringing kind of the union order to Georgia for the textile industries.
So, Stephen, what kind of historical significance does that, having these kind of, because he preserved both sides of this communication. So what kind of historical significance is it to have this much detail on this discussion?
I think it's having it in such a clear linear fashion. It's very neatly filed, laid out. You can see the interactions between the union, the mill owners, and the National War Labor Board. And just being able to go through it in a straight fashion and turn pages and read a coherent story is remarkable, because often, as you said, often we have just one side of the story. And then a lot of the fun of the collection, too, is there's so much even beyond that, showing in back of these negotiations, the daily way the mill operates, production. You can almost see the mill running through these documents. Right down to, we mentioned the mill village, I'm sitting here with a brochure of mill cottage paints. They saved wonderful little detailed ephemera. So that in addition to seeing the general flow of business and union negotiations, you really have the whole mill sort of buzzing away in the background, and you get a very complete picture of everything that's going on during this war production.
Nathan, how important was this mill to the community of Greensboro at that time?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, back in the 40s, they had an annual payroll of over 300,000. So you can imagine running three shifts. I think they had about 350 people that were employed directly by the mill. That's not to, you know, nowadays we count employment by, you know, secondary tiers, but directly by the mill, 350 people. That's a huge economic driver in a small town.
It is. If you're just joining us, my guests are developer Nathan McGarity and archivist Stephen Brown. We're talking about a 19th century cotton mill in Greensboro. It's now being developed into a craft brewery with apartments. But we're talking about the discovery of some documents and photos that were in the rafters and crates in the rafters that have opened up sort of a window to history. And the reason I asked Nathan about how important it was is because what Stephen's describing, the day-to-day workings of the mill, to a certain extent, this discovery has let us understand what life was like for people in Greensboro because the mill was so much a crucial part of the community.
Yeah, I think it was, and we see here Gideon Brooks was the curator of these documents. He was the manager from 1946 that put these documents into the boxes and nailed them shut. But what you see here is the humanity behind both the employee and the management, and also the union. And you see kind of all sides and how they were intertangled. It's very much like some of those films that you would see, where it gives you a viewpoint from everybody. And often it's not the view is not what you thought it was when you first read it in the history books.
So, Stephen, how do you go about archiving this kind of collection? What kind of time commitment is it? And then how many different areas of study does it relate to?
Well, it's not as much a time commitment as some of the collections we receive that have been serving as nests for squirrels or accumulating other trash since this was so clean. But we do need to put it in a coherent order. I did not process this collection. I have a feeling that probably Mr. Brooks left it in a pretty logical order. Is that right, Nathan?
That's correct. I'm sorry if we messed it up for you when we brought it in, but we had been thumbing through it for a couple years there. So,
well, no, it looks very well organized and easy to access. So it probably was not as big a time commitment. Now, of course, we want to move every piece of paper into a neutral environment because acid is definitely the enemy of
acid
all the papers.
That so can be on our fingers.
Now, on our fingers, greases on our fingers, but particularly in the papers. So the boxes, the folders we place these materials in are completely neutral as far as acid. This collection does not contain a lot of newspaper. That's normally where we get into serious problems when there's a lot of news clippings because newspaper is very acidic. This all seems to be very stable material. We've sleeved the photographs because the oils on human fingers are very bad on photographic paper. And then, of course, contrary to how it has lived in the past, lived very well, we're putting it in a much cooler, drier environment. So we hope we can get a good deal more than even the amazing 70 years that we've got it out of collection already.
Yeah, I assume it doesn't go back into pine boxes. So, Nathan, knowing this history, how does that influence, if it does, your development and how you go about renovating this property?
Well, first of all, I think it was a great inspiration for preserving the property. I mean, it was one of those things that the building at the time that we were able to finally get financing worked out, it had already had a partial collapse, and most people would have looked at it and said, you know, go ahead and push the rest of the wall over and bring down the last bit of roof. But you just, when it has that much history, and rather interesting, the building that they were actually doing the brewery in was actually part of a Cherokola bottling plant. The mill acquired it during the Great Depression so that they could maintain three shifts for their employees to still be able to pay the bills. And
they were diversifying so that they wouldn't have to lay people off.
Well, that's true, but I'd like to see a company do that today. And I mean, for somebody to take that much care of their employees is just absolutely astounding. And the building that it goes from bottling plant to private ownership of the mill to union control, and actually some of the funds that we're using are actually federal funds, so we have to use union wages to preserve the building that preserved the document that was preserved by the guy who hated the unions. It's rather odd, and then it's going to be private, back to a bottling plant, so it's kind of a historical palindrome.
How many buildings are on this property, separate buildings?
You really could break out the site into its multiple buildings, but the site altogether was about 14 acres. The two oldest structures are under construction right now and be opening up in early September for the loft apartments. We're doing the brewery right now in the building that actually carried the finished product during the Great Depression. And then there's still 9 acres and the walls of a cotton bale opening warehouse that's left. And the city of Greensboro is absolutely phenomenal for their progressive ideas. So they're certainly open to new ideas on that property as well.
On how to take care of it. That is Nathan Bagarity. He's a developer in Greensboro, Georgia. He's talking about the renovations of a former cotton mill there. And Stephen Brown is an archivist emeritus at the University of Georgia's Hargrett Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Celeste.
Thank you.
In other brewing news, beer giant Miller Coors has acquired a majority stake of Terrapin Brewing Company. Terrapin is based in Athens. The popular local brand will be assigned to Miller Coors Craft Brewery Division, 10th and Blake. Financial details have not yet been disclosed, but the transaction is expected to be completed by next month.
Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer.
Atlanta became an Olympic city 20 years ago. One of the most celebrated moments from the Games was when champion fighter Muhammad Ali surprised the world and lit the flame at the opening ceremonies. Retired Georgia State Trooper Johnny B. Hall had the chance to meet Ali in Atlanta 20 years ago. He was part of the security team at the opening ceremony of the 1996 Olympic Games, and his assignment that night was an unforgettable one.
My name is Johnny B. Hall. I was employed by the Department of Public Safety and I had a total of 31 years. And I was signed to the 1996 Olympics. And that's how I come in contact with the Muhammad Ali. I couldn't believe it. Just a little old state trip from South Georgia don't handle a detail like this. I said, it's unreal. Ali lit the Olympic torch. I was within 2 feet of it. And there's no word can describe how I felt. And because I did something that nobody else ever done with Muhammad Ali.
Once the most dynamic figure in sports, a gregarious man, now trapped inside that mask created Parkinson's syndrome, so in one sense a poignant figure, but look at him. Still a great, great presence.
You could tell that it was that he had it, but I watched him at the Olympic Stadium that night, and after he stood up and took a few steps and he lit the torch and it was all over with. That he did shadow boxing with me just a little bit, and she says, "How long has it been patrolled?" And I said, "Whatever come next, we'll go from there." He said, "With your type attitude," he said, "you're gonna go a long way with the patrolling," which I did. Well, after it was all over with, and I returned home. I looked through that album, I guarantee you 100 times. And every time I get to that page with Muhammad Ali, I just sit there and just smile. And it's a feeling that you won't never forget.
CBS News has learned that Muhammad Ali is dead. The boxing icon was hospitalized on Thursday with respiratory problems made worse by Parkinson's disease. He was 74 years old.
When I heard about it on the news that morning, I was up and I watched the news and I kind of shed some tears and sat there for a while and I said, well, that's a very, very good man and we won't never forget him and he's going to always be in my heart.
I flew like a butterfly. Sing like a hornet.
That was retired Georgia State Trooper Johnny B. Hall sharing his memories of Muhammad Ali. To relive the moment in 1996 when the champ lit the Olympic torch in Atlanta, visit gpbnews.org. On second thought. After the killings of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge, some cities have imposed curfews, but we wondered if curfews really work. Have you ever been in a city in which you've had to abide by a curfew? What did you think? Did it work for you and did you feel safer? Be part of the discussion. Call us at 404-500-9457 and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Governor Nathan Deal has pushed for criminal justice reform throughout his tenure. That includes education and occupational training behind bars. One training program has felons going from cell block to the firehouse. GPB's Leah Fleming takes us to a middle Georgia town where some volunteer firefighters are actually convicted felons at the state pen.
In the middle of Chester, a rural town about an hour from Macon, sits the Dodge County State Prison. Ride through the open gate and you see the typical looking prison surrounded by barbed wire. But to the left is a firehouse complete with two bays where shiny red trucks sit pointed toward the road. Outside, a couple of men casually talk. Their shirts read, Georgia Correctional Fire Services. These are inmates serving time as firefighters. Corrections Officer Matthew Kelly is the station fire chief, and he's the only paid professional on staff.
They're not locked in. We are still within the guard line of the prison, so they do have officers that come out here, do routine checks and counts.
One of the team of five is David Foxworth of Tifton.
I was originally locked up, arrested for a drug possession charge and a forgery charge.
Foxworth was paroled at one point, but he's back after a probation violation. He spent some time working as an orderly in the warden's office, but then he decided to follow in his grandfather's footsteps and become a firefighter. Dodge is one of 25 state and county prisons with firefighting programs. Sean Wombles oversees the fire service at prisons all across the state.
They go through a real tough interview process and then have to pass a physical agility test and meet our criteria, which is nonviolent offenses, no sexual offenses, no arson convictions, and they must be working toward their GED or already have a high school diploma.
Foxworth, along with the other four felons at Dodge, now hold all the certifications that a paid firefighter in Georgia has. And Sean Womble says, when you call 911 in Dodge, these are the guys coming to you under an escort.
We have an automatic aid agreement with the city of Chester. They would get in their fire trucks that you've seen in our bays here, and they would respond down to wherever the call may be.
Not every county in Georgia can afford to pay for firefighting services. Nearly one-third of Georgia's 159 counties look to the prison system to serve as fire protection. It's funded through the state. As for the firefighters at Dodge, they have been on several calls, including one that stays in David Foxworth's mind.
Years ago with Chief Kelly, I found a victim inside, and his own children come up crying and hugging my neck telling me thank you when their father had just passed away. The appreciation and the gratitude that they have for us, it's a high that no drug could ever give me.
Program manager Sean Womble says over 50 inmates have gone on to serve as firefighters after being paroled. As for Foxworth, he expects to be paroled sometime next year. He says he's already lined up an opportunity in a neighboring community to be a firefighter once he gets out. That's a start, he says. For GPB News, I'm Leah Fleming in Macon.
You can see photos of the firefights from a recent training demonstration. They're at gpbnews.org.
Fire!
Now let's talk about some fictional heroes. A new graphic novel takes us back into early 20th century Jekyll Island history. Back then, the tiny Georgia island was a hotspot for some of the most powerful and wealthy people in the country, like William Rockefeller, Joseph Pulitzer, and Henry Ford. It's called the Jekyll Island Chronicles, and it blends historical fact with some alternate history, all with the help of students from the Savannah College of Art and Design, known as SCAD. Joining me is Ed Kroll. He's the co-author of the Jekyll Island Chronicles. Recently came back from San Diego's Comic-Con, and very recently, right, Ed?
Very recently indeed. Good morning.
Good morning. Did you land at 3 a.m. or something, I heard?
Finally got back to the house about that time, but that's all right. It's great to be up and talking with you.
Well, I'm glad that you're conscious. Also with us is Moses Nestor. He's a recent graduate from the Savannah College of Art and Design and illustrated the series. Hi, Moses.
Hi, how's it going?
You didn't go to San Diego Comic-Con?
Oh, I did. I just came back a little bit earlier than Ed did.
Oh, okay. So you've had a little bit more rest.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ed, let's start with you because we start with the story. Do we not? Why? I mean, I don't want to give any spoilers. So let me try to give a broad stroke description if I can, and you can correct me. Basically, some of the main characters are some of the most powerful people of that period, which is the age in between World War I and World War II. So we see Nikola Tesla, we see Rockefeller, we see President Woodrow Wilson, and a new threat, almost a terrorist threat in many ways, arises, one that is just not historical. How did you separate what was real from where you started to use your imagination?
Well, actually, you got it pretty close to exactly right. The only difference is we didn't separate, we blended. That is, we took some of the reality of that situation, the reality of that era, because we knew we wanted to do a period piece in that era, and blended it with our fiction to make the story that we've got. The part of the beauty of it is so much of it is historical. There actually were anarchists and terrorists running around in that era doing some of the things we describe in the book, and it just fit beautifully with the plot of the story.
And Moses, let me ask you the same question, but from an art standpoint, to what extent did you use real photos of these people, and to what extent did you imagine something that went more in line with their fictional persona?
So for all of the historical figures, the characters themselves, we used lots of photo reference to make sure that we nailed the look of the characters. Some of the technology that I portray does actually come from that period, but a lot of the tech I created it. I designed it based on like certain design motifs and technology that was available at the time. So it's mostly the tech that's the fantastical part.
It's almost as though you blended real pictures of what we know of Edison and Tesla's laboratory with a steampunk.
Oh yeah, I love sticking little fun steampunk and diesel punk looking contraptions into the background of these shots. But yes, most of the locations, including like the Lightning Factory, were real locations, and that I used reference photos for. The authors were very helpful in that. They sent me tons and tons of material to look through to really nail the look of these places.
So, Ed, you had this little slice in history, and I feel like it was almost necessary that you did it at this time because by the time World War II came around, Jekyll Island was evacuated, and so you had sort of this window in which you could have put this story. What did the time period, how did it influence the way your story was crafted?
Well, there were a couple of reasons we went with that time period. One was it was a great time of change. It's one of the sad facts of life that wars exist, but when they exist, they push technology. They make major changes in society. And World War I was no exception. It was a huge, global event, and it changed things dramatically. And it gave us a tension to work with between the sort of Edwardian era, if you would, the Downton Abbey look and feel, and the gritty technology, the machine age that was coming into play or was really in full force then. It gave us a great setting for that plot. So it was the right place to do it. It also gave us that ability to do sort of the steampunk and use those historical characters because by the time World War II rolls around, a lot of them are off the stage.
So there's also another question, Ed, which is the balance between portraying these characters in their in all of the blemishes of real life and portraying them more as historic figures. And in this case, I'm not talking about the sort of semi-superheroes that I won't give any more details about, but I'm talking about the captains of industry, because the other title, obviously, that many of us know of these captains of industry is robber barons. How did you deal with the sort of moral quandaries that surrounded these men and their wealth?
Well, in most cases, to be honest, we didn't. That is, this is a fiction work, and it's not historical in the sense of getting into a listing of all the good they did and all the bad they did. That would be a historical tome that'd be much larger and probably not as much fun to read.
Or illustrate, so, you know, right, Moses?
Yeah, or illustrate. We needed them to be what they were on Jekyll Island, or what we wanted them to be on Jekyll Island, which is basically the resources to help these other good people get done what needed to get done. So they add that to the story. We don't do a lot of backstory on any of the titans of industry, if you will. They're important to the story, but they're not central to the story.
Right. It moves on quickly from them. My guests are Ed Kroll, whose voice you just heard. He's the co-author of The Jekyll Island Chronicles, a new graphic novel series. And also with us is Moses Nestor, who illustrated the graphic novel. And Moses, you actually began these illustrations as a student in SCAD. How did this project work from something you were doing from school into something you were doing as a profession?
Well, I was involved first with the project through a special program that SCAD does called the Collaborative Learning Center, where clients can come to the school with a project that they want to see made a reality, and the school will create actually a class based around that project and then invite students whose work fits the criteria for that project. So for Jekyll Island Chronicles, I was lucky to be selected with a bunch of other students to help create a pitch packet for the story for Ed and Jack and Steve to take to publishers. And over the course of that class, I got to meet these guys, became friends with them. And when the project was over, I was lucky enough to be able to continue to work on it along with Sarah Miller, the colorist for the book. We were both on the same CLC project.
Ed, did you have concern? Look, I probably would not go get my hair cut at a student. You know, you can get your hair cut by student hairstylists. So did you have any concerns when you took this project, which was obviously meant so much to you, to students?
Well, no, and I'll tell you why. There were two other co-authors on this book, Jack Lowe and Steve Nevedek, and Steve in particular had experience working with SCAD in the corporate environment and was familiar with the sort of project Moses just described. We were excited about the prospect. We knew the kind of students that SCAD produces. We knew the kind of work that SCAD students are capable of when they're interning, and what they do beyond that. And so it was just a great way for us to get from the plot that we'd created and the characters we've created and get them into reality, if you will, on the page. It was a wonderful process working with them and all of the students, and Moses and Sarah just became our go-to people out of the project. And when we sat down and said, okay, how do we go forward with this, we took the pitch packet, a publisher jumped on it, said they want to publish the book, and we knew right away we wanted Moses and Sarah to be in the project and help finish it off.
So, Moses, how much of what we're seeing in this, and the artwork is beautiful, but how much
Thanks.
Of it is Moses' personality, and how much of it is transformed by you into something that fits this time period and this style?
A lot of my personality, I guess, in the artwork comes through my inking style. I use a bunch of I do everything digitally, but I use a lot of...
Wait, what does that mean?
Instead of sitting at an actual piece of paper, drawing it on pencil, drawing it with ink, I do everything in Photoshop.
Original drawings?
Yep. Oh. I have a graphic tablet. It's called a Huion. A GT220 is the technical term for it. But it allows me to take a stylus and draw on the screen. And so I will set up a document that's the size of a regular 11x17 sheet and pencil it on the computer, ink it on the computer. But a lot of my a lot of the brushes that I use are designed to mimic traditional media, like dry brush effects, some gritty spattering and stuff like that. And that's where I put my twist on everything, is in how I render the characters.
What does rendering a character mean?
Oh, just how I ink them, I guess. I like it to look a little dirty, a little grungy, so that it kind of fits the diesel punk theme of the book.
Right, which is very much sustained throughout the whole thing. Ed, how many episodes are there in these chronicles?
Well, the arrangement is to do 6 books. So this is book one. The title of book one is A Machine Age War. And book two is underway at this time. But hopefully there'll be 6 by the time it's finished.
Is it all written?
It is not all written, but it's already in production. Moses has already started working on some of the art for us.
So, but do you know how it ends? Do you already have sort of an arc in your head?
We do. We've actually taken the arc all the way through to the end of this, and then we go back and we'll flesh it out as need be. Book one is very much an introduction to the characters and to the world that's involved here. Book two is going to get a little more in depth on the backstory of two of our characters, Peter Karavik, who is one of our main heroes, and Helen Huxley, the lead heroine of the story, if you will.
A very empowered
we're find
woman.
Out more about that.
Excuse the pun.
No. Very much so.
She can shoot lightning out of her hands, which I hope I'm not giving anything away by saying that.
And it's sometimes much more troublesome than people realize. It really bothers her at times.
Yeah, I would imagine that would not be easy to handle. Well, we will wait for the next 5 issues as well, but you can get the first of the Jekyll Island Chronicles now. That's Ed Kroll, co-author of the series, and also Moses Nestor joined us. He illustrates the graphic novel. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks
for having us.
That is our show for today, but I wonder, okay, so what historical figure would you turn into a comic book hero or heroine? Abraham Lincoln was already turned into a vampire hunter, so lop Abraham Lincoln out. But what real person could become a comic book hero? Eleanor Roosevelt? Teddy Roosevelt? Maybe a rampaging Marie Curie? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can also post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. I think Rasputin has already been a comic book villain in a few arcs. But you can give that as a suggestion as well. Anyway, for today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.